Good morning, counsel. May it please the court, my name is Mike Reagan. I represent the appellant plaintiff here, Grinnell Insurance Company. The anti-stacking limit of liability provisions in this policy are clear.
Before we get to the merits, I have a question that may bear on jurisdiction. What's the status of the underlying state litigation?
It is pending and stayed pending the resolution of this case.
And what's the status of the policyholders? I noticed that they aren't here.
They are not, Your Honor.
The reason I ask this is because Illinois is not a direct action state, and this seems to have proceeded as if it were possible to have a dispute between a potential tort victim and an insurance company rather than a dispute between an insurance company and its insured. A dispute between Grinnell and the Bakers just doesn't seem to be proper. The Georgias don't seem to be here, and there's nothing in this record which suggests that the underlying litigation puts the difference between $100,000 and $200,000 even in question.
There is, I would respond in two ways. The matter was not raised in the briefs, and so I don't have the
subject exact matter jurisdiction is always.
I understand. I absolutely agree. The court has the right to raise the question. I believe there is
a case. We have the obligation to raise the question, as did you.
I understand. My understanding of Illinois law is that a case called, and I may have the order of the cases of the names reversed, Ragor, R-E-A-G-O-R versus Travelers, or Travelers versus Ragor, makes it plain in Illinois law that there is a sufficient dispute between the tort claimants and the liability carrier, that the tort claimants have standing to dispute this, and indeed to file a declaratory judgment action. Secondly, this court's opinion in Bankers Trust, and I don't have the exact site here, I have it somewhere but not in my hands, affirmed a district court finding in a case called Mohring, M-O-E-H-R-I-N-G, which is not reported in FedSup but has a Westlaw citation, in which in a case exactly like this was entertained, and Judge Posner said in the Bankers Trust opinion that we are dealing with a probabilistic type injury. Now here
Look, we have said, and I'm sure Illinois has said, that if you have a genuine dispute between the insurer and the insured, the victim is also a proper and perhaps even a necessary party. The question I'm trying to figure out is whether there is a genuine dispute between the insurer and the insured. And that depends first on whether the Georgias have any interest in this indemnity, and if their lack of participation here suggests perhaps not. And second, on whether in the underlying litigation the Georgias are at risk for a judgment between $100,000 and $200,000. And if we know nothing about the underlying litigation, it's hard to know the answer to that question.
The parties would agree, the Grinnell would agree, that the amount at risk here is in excess of $100,000. We believe that our limits are $100,000. We have taken the extraordinary step of paying them. And the case may well be settled if this court says that we have to pay $200,000, but we don't think that we have to. Now, Illinois law, as I understand it, and I would be delighted to have the opportunity to submit a supplemental memorandum to the court, is that even if the insurers were to be defaulted here, as they are in most cases, that does not conclude the controversy, and that under the Ragor case, the tort claimants have sufficient standing and an interest in the outcome because they are the people who want the money, that they have the right to file a litigation and to continue. And I leave it to the court as to whether we have the right to submit a briefing on that point, but I'm confident. And I'd also say in my experience that this is most often the format of insurance declaratory judgments proceeding in Illinois state courts, and that is that the insured seldom has the wherewithal to conduct the fight, but that the tort claimant has a direct interest in the outcome of the litigation, and it is they and their attorney who proceed.
Let me add something that seemed a little odd to me here. You asked us to certify questions to the Illinois Supreme Court, yet you file this case in federal court. could have filed in state court. That seems sort of odd.
Well, my response to that is twofold. First of all, we have great respect for the abilities of the federal district court and this court.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, why?
So that's why you want us to certify, right?
That's why you want
us. What you want is the best of two options.
You want two options.
If you want to go to state court, you win, that's fine. If you lose, you want to go to state court.
There are several other factors here. The second is that we are, if we had filed in state court, it would have been in the 5th District, geographically in Illinois, which is where the Hall court came from, the Hall case comes from. And so this gives us then the opportunity to reason to this court as to why Hall is not applicable. In response to Judge Easterbrook's comment,
if you lose there, then you could go to the Illinois Supreme Court and get this question answered that you want us to certify.
We could.
Your forum.
Yeah, we could.
It just seemed odd to pick a federal forum and then ask us to certify the case to state.
Okay. Well, in response to your comment, also in response to Judge Easterbrook's comment, we have asked for relief in the alternative here. We believe that the Hall authority is so insubstantial when you look at how plain this declaration's page is, that we respectfully ask this court to reverse the district court outright. But we pose to the court the option that if there were some question as to the viability of the Hall authority, that the matter be certified to the Illinois Supreme Court.
What are the persuasive indications that the Illinois Supreme Court would decide this case any differently?
Yes. The getting right to the heart of that.
Yeah, that's what I want.
I understand from having sat here this morning. That Yates, and as we've said in our brief, Yates is the pivot point. Now, Yates doesn't decide this issue. But Yates, there's a case that Justice Wolfson wrote in the First District called Bowman, in which he said, we are kind of unpersuaded, we are unpersuaded by the Fifth District's opinion in Yates, and the trial judge was compelled to follow it, but we're not. And even though we question the reasoning of all of that, we're going to stay here until we're instructed otherwise. So the First District doesn't follow Yates. The Fourth District, in a case called Pekin versus Ritter, says we don't follow Yates. And both the First District case and the Fourth District case are exactly like this policy. Now, the only thing that's different is that in Hall, which is the only case in Illinois, and indeed the only case in the country, despite the fact that this is a nationally employed form, says that, well, we find that this language on the declaration page of the policy is sufficient to create an ambiguity. But the same policy in both the First District and the Fourth District passed muster. So my response to your question is that there is no Illinois Supreme Court case on point, that Hall relies on Yates completely. I mean, it's really the only case that the Fifth District cited in Hall, and yet the First and the Fourth District say, look, you know, Yates is unpersuasive to us, and we're not going to follow it. And the second part of my answer to your question is that this court's cases, including AAR Aircraft, make it clear that if there is a question or some doubt to think that the intermediate appellate court stated the law correctly, or if the intermediate appellate court's analysis was cursory, that those are reasons why the court need not follow the intermediate appellate authority and to proceed to decide the question. And so we have asked, I'm intruding upon my time here, but we have asked that the court read the declarations page, and I'm sure that you have, but I mean the methodology I would suggest is that we read the declarations page and decide for yourself whether it is ambiguous. So I'd like to save some time. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Mark Prince, and I'm here on behalf of the Bakers. Let me begin by addressing the jurisdictional issue that was raised by Judge Easterbrook. Mm-hmm. As far as the status of the underlying litigation, it is still pending in the Circuit Court of Swing County. It is stayed by agreement of the parties pending the outcome of this decision. Grinnell has paid us $100,000 in response to our request, and we have waived certain rights, including the ability or the right to collect any excess verdict over and against the Georgias, the named insureds. That agreement isn't part of the record, but that is how we are now before this court, and this is how the complaint for declaratory judgment was fashioned. You'd also raised the question about the Georgias' interest and why aren't the Georgias here, and is there really standing for this case to be here. There's a case out of the 5th District of Illinois called Skidmore versus Throgmorton, I believe it is, and it addresses this very issue, where basically the tort claimant is considered almost a third-party beneficiary of the contract between Grinnell and the Bakers, and as such, we have standing to challenge the coverage issues as far as the limit of liability is concerned. Another issue that was raised by this court with Mr. Reagan was the certification issue. Frankly, we're in federal court right now because they beat me in the race to the courthouse. We were prepared to venue this in the Circuit Court of Swain County, but they
sounds like they would have removed it anyway.
They probably would have, Your Honor. I think they could have done so. So that is how we are now before this court. I think this court asked the key question here is, under the Erie Doctrine, is what persuasive indications are there from the Supreme Court that they would not follow Hall? I don't think that there are any indications from the Supreme Court at all that they would not follow Hall. Hall right now is the only court or the only decision in the state of Illinois that has precisely addressed this issue. Mr. Reagan attempts to say that the Doman case and perhaps even the Ritter case offer some indications of what the Supreme Court would do. Well, with all due respect, those are First and Fourth District cases. Doman doesn't even address the issue. We're not even sure that the offending phrase, the coverage is provided where a premium and limit of liability is shown, is even present on the declarations page. It certainly isn't argued, and it certainly wasn't a basis for the court's decision to disallow stacking in Doman, because it rested primarily on the fact that there were not multiple printings of the limit of liability coverage. The Ritter case that Grinnell relies upon is a strange case. Up until Hall, all the cases in Illinois that have allowed stacking, even the Bruder dicta, has contemplated a situation where there had been multiple printings of the limit of liability coverage on the declarations page. That is the basis for the ambiguity in the policy. In 1993, Bruder in dicta started these lines of cases by saying that the policy they were looking at was unambiguous because there wasn't multiple printing. But they go on to say, if we were confronted with a situation where there were multiple printings of the limit of liability coverage, it would be entirely reasonable for a consumer to conclude that he has that amount of coverage for each vehicle insured. Well, Ritter acknowledges that. The Fourth District Appellate Court acknowledges the Bruder dicta, but they say, we're not going to follow it. So even though they're confronted with a multiple printing situation, they don't even follow the Supreme Court, so what vitality or viability that decision has is questionable. Basically, what it comes down to is, when you look at the limit of liability coverage, it purports to restrict coverage. It says that the most we will pay is the amount shown in the declarations page, regardless of the number of vehicles or insured or premiums paid. It refers the reader to the declarations page to determine the amount and type of coverage. When you go to the declarations page then, and you read it, it expands coverage. It says coverage is provided where a premium and limit of liability is shown. On this declarations page, it's set up where there are two vehicles with a $100,000, $300,000 occurrence, and a premium shown under each vehicle, under each of the two vehicles. So when the consumer reads that, and we all know that's typically where where the reading of the policy ends is at the declarations page to see how much coverage we have. The reader, as the Bruder Court has told us, and has Gobin and Yates and Hall and Allen from this court, have all told us that it's perfectly reasonable for the reader to conclude that he has that coverage multiplied times the number of vehicles shown. So the consumer then is left with the issue of how much is my coverage? Is it $100,000 or is it $200,000? That, in a nutshell, is the ambiguity here. And the rules of contract construction are very well settled in Illinois, that if there is an ambiguity, is very, very liberally construed in favor of the insured and very strictly construed against the insurer. So with those principles in mind, the decision of the district court should be affirmed. This policy should be found to be stacking, to allow the stack to provide $200,000 in limit of liability coverage to the Bakers. Without any further questions?
Counsel, is it proper for and truly reasonable to interpret the phrase coverage is provided where a premium and the limit of liability is shown for coverage rather than the usual existence of coverage for that particular vehicle?
I think it's eminently reasonable.
It's more reasonable than...
I think under either scenario, Your Honor, it's reasonable.
Right.
There is no difference. As the district court concluded in his opinion, in fact, the offending language in this case may even be more ambiguous because there is a premium shown and there is a limit of liability shown.
I just asked you.
Sure.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
You have 1 minute, sir.
Excuse me. The site of the Bankers Trust case, Justice Easterbrook, is 959 Fed Second 677. This is a national forum. It is recognized, is recommended by the ISO, the Insurance Services Office. We have shown in our brief how it is used in substantially similar form, even outside the ISO forum. There is one case in one appellate district in one state in the entire country which says that this is an ambiguous policy. I really would request the court to look at, not now, but at page A17, which is the declaration page, and to ask how a more efficient, clear form could have been drawn up. It shows the limits for each vehicle. It shows the cost to the insured. The counsel just told you that the reading of the policy by most insureds ends at the declaration page. Well, that's impermissible. I mean, obviously, the entire policy has to be written together. And it is not reasonable to say, to read the words coverage is provided where a premium is shown to mean that you get to multiply the limits by the number of vehicles involved. So what my primary problem at this point is, time's up.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Court will take the case under advisement.